All right. We'll call the Senate Health and Human Services Finance Division together for Wednesday, March 4th. Let the record note, we have a quorum at 8:34. That's pretty impressive. I'm pleased to see it. We have four bills on the agenda today. We're going to start with Senate File 552. Senator Pappas, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for taking me first. And I do have an author's amendment, the A1 amendment.
Senator Franzen moves the A1 amendment.
Yeah, this was something that Ms. White discovered.
We don't have it yet.
That we needed to add to the bill to be more clear on the purpose.
Okay. It's pretty straightforward, just a clarity issue on the A1 amendment. We don't have it. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have, as you know, with me Mr. Bauer from the Family Partnership, and he's going to give us a little history about what's been going on with the Safe Harbor legislation that we passed. But I did want to call to your attention an article that was on NPR and in the Star Tribune and the Pioneer Press about the latest bust by Ramsey County Attorney, the police, and Ramsey County Attorney John Choi is giving the press conference. And I just wanted to note that in this bust of the, I think there were five or six victims, two of them are underage, 16, 17. And because of our safe harbor legislation, those girls now will be treated as victims, will not be taken to juvenile court, but will be taken to a safe shelter where they are not locked in, but their pimps and their traffickers are locked out so that they can receive appropriate services. If appropriate, they can be reunited with their families, therapeutic treatment, but to really stay in a safe home, not a jail, while they're getting their lives back together. And so I really wanted to thank this committee for being so supportive. Unfortunately, we're here because we have not yet fully funded the Safe Harbor bill that we promised to do a couple years ago when we passed the law. So there will and can still be situations throughout the state where there aren't enough beds for girls to be taken to, and that we're still scrambling for what to do with them. And, you know, we've even had facilities that had opened but then had to close because they didn't receive enough funding and couldn't take resources from their other programs to subsidize this. So it's still very important, this work that we do, and I'll turn it over then to Mr. Bauer.
Mr. Bauer, welcome to the committee. Please state your name again for the record and present your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. Thanks for having me here. I'm Jeff Bauer, the Director of Public Policy at the Family Partnership. We are the home to the Pride Program, which for over 35 years now has been working with women and girls escaping trafficking and sexual exploitation. I want to start out by thanking, of course, Senator Pappas, our author of every bill we've ever had on this topic. Thank you for doing this once again. And our co-authors as well, Senator Sharon, Senator Franz, and Senator Eakin, and Senator Rosen for co-authoring this legislation. We really appreciate it. And I also always have to thank Joan and Dennis and Stacy for their patience and their skill in dealing with this issue year in and year out. We appreciate you, too. So nearly 4 years ago, as you remember now, Minnesota became the fifth state in the nation to pass a safe harbor law. That was a really historic vote at that time, and we've been really busy since then. And so the law officially went into effect in August of 2014, so the law's only been in effect for a little while. But during that time, we really have accomplished a lot. And so first of which is we now have 21 partially funded shelter beds around the state. When we started, there were four, and so that's good progress. We have 13 Safe Harbor-funded comprehensive service projects all around the state, everything from mental health counseling to chemical dependency to education, all of the things these children need. There are now 13 projects funded around the state. There have been over 1,000 law enforcement professionals trained all around the state of Minnesota, not only to investigate these crimes, but to more accurately identify victims. And that's a big deal, too. And last but not least, we have 8 regional navigators in place now all over the state. And the regional navigators are really important because those are the people who, wherever a victim is identified, they can connect that victim to the shelter and the services and the help that they need. And so we're really proud of that. That being said, we've been back here with the same number for a couple of years now. The number is $13.3 million. That's the number it takes to fully fund Minnesota's safe harbor model. And I do want to point out, too, really quickly, is this isn't just a model for Minnesota. I've been out in Washington, D.C. recently doing congressional briefings with 41 states present who wanted to learn about Minnesota's model for dealing with child sex trafficking. And so we're building something for the entire country, not just our own state. So we sit today at $5 million in the base budget for fiscal year 16-17. That's great progress, and I want to thank you all for it. I know some of those dollars have been hard fought over these last couple of years. But we are 38% funded right now in terms of our safe harbor model. So we're back again this year. We're asking for $8.3 million additional dollars for safe harbor, and that breaks down as the following. $4 million additional for safe shelter and housing. You know, currently we fund four projects around the state, but it's important for members to know no project is fully funded by safe harbor dollars from the state. All of these organizations are working really, really hard to raise their own money, to match the state's investment, to do their part to keep these beds running. And that's really challenging. So not only are the projects we have not fully funded, but there are still a number of areas all over the state that just don't have shelter yet. And so we need to fully fund the ones we have, and we need to spread out our geography so that these kids have a place to go. The second piece we're asking for is an additional $2 million to go into the Comprehensive Services Grant Fund. They were able to fund 13 projects, like I said, around the state. Some of those are culturally specific services. Some of those are legal services, chemical dependency, a wide range of services. But like the housing, you know, we still have a lot of the state that we haven't covered yet. And we have a lot of kids that we're not getting to. So we're hoping to do that. The third piece, and this is something I'm really excited about. And Mr. Chair, I know early in the session, you had us and our friends with Homeless Youth Act sit down and find some ways to work together. And luckily, we like each other, and our work overlaps a lot. And so we did that. And we're asking for an additional $800,000. And what this would be for is 18 youth outreach workers around the state. We know that youth outreach workers really are the best way to connect with a lot of these youth. And those youth outreach workers would actually be cross-trained. They would be working with homeless youth, runaway youth, sexually exploited youth. They would know how to make the appropriate referrals based on what they find. And we're really excited to work together on that endeavor. And then the final piece that we're asking for is an additional $1.5 million for training and protocol development. We had a one-time allocation in 2013 that allowed us to train a number of law enforcement professionals, but that's really where the training kind of stopped, and we weren't able to get to other frontline folks in other disciplines who might encounter these children, and we'd really like to do that. That would be really important for us. So I'll just wrap up and say this. You know, 4 years ago, we passed the Safe Harbor Law, and it was a historic law, a nation-leading law. But for me, having traveled now all over the state and met a lot of these kids, it's also that we made a promise to them that we would protect them, that we wouldn't let this happen to them. And while we're testifying today, there are still Minnesota kids getting trafficked up to the oil fields in North Dakota. They're getting trafficked right here in St. Paul. They're getting trafficked in greater Minnesota. We've made some headway, but we haven't yet fulfilled that promise that we made that we would protect kids in the state of Minnesota. So I'm asking the committee today to please consider going the rest of the way with this legislative session, and fulfill that promise. So we'd be happy to stand for any questions the committee has.
Well, Mr. Bauer, welcome back to the committee. Thank you for the update on the important work that you've been doing. I know you have a lot of advocates here on the committee, and I am glad that you're working with the rest of the homeless coalitions to try to coordinate as best we can, and wherever there's overlap, make sure that we're making the best investments. It gets very difficult as we're trying to, at the end of the day, balance scarce resources, and we need to make sure that we do that coordination. And so I very much appreciate your willingness to sit down. I gave that message to both sides, and you came back together and said you'd worked on some areas where you could really coordinate, and that's appreciated. Senator Rosen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Bauer, it's I believe I've been Senator Pappas on this bill for the last 4 years, and I do believe this is a worthy bill. And Mr. Bauer, you're just about the nicest guy I know.
You are right super back nice, at you, Senator.
However, we are in front of the Budget Committee, and I do have a couple questions about some of the financing. The $800,000 for 18 youth outreach workers, that's about $40,000 each, along, I mean, you know, give and take with some training in there. That seems like, you know, a fairly significant amount for youth outreach. We're not quite sure where these youth outreach are coming. Is that youth, or is that from a different program, and how does that fit in with the training of the $750,000 for the frontline personnel statewide? No, actually, the $1.2 million for statewide training. So there seems to be a little bit of a, we need to have that clarified as far as where is this money going and to whom.
Yeah. Thank you, Senator Rosen, Mr. Chair. So to clarify, these aren't youth who are doing the youth outreach. These are actually very well-trained youth outreach workers as a profession. And so they go through very extensive training in order to do this. Many of them actually have been homeless youth maybe in the past, and now this is what they're doing for their career. You know, $40,000 we think is a fair salary for somebody who's spending long days and nights out on the streets connecting with youth who are vulnerable, who need a place to go. It's tough work. It's really important work. And so that's where that number came from. In terms of the training, the training more broadly, you know, we're really talking about a very wide range of frontline personnel who might encounter sexually exploited youth. So for example, emergency room personnel or social workers at schools, any number of other disciplines who we haven't gotten to yet, that's what that grant fund would be available for.
Well, and maybe I could insert too, the $800,000 is actually a biennial figure. So when you divide the 18 by the annual figure, it's $22,000 per year.
Correct, Mr. Chair.
And, you know, one other thing, we got a note from DHS, apparently there's also some administrative costs. It won't preclude you from being laid on the table, but I'd like the committee to know that in order to implement this, DHS has alerted us that we'll have to get a fiscal note put together and find out there will be some cost for administering this program, and we don't have that before us right now. But I think that we could lay it on the table, and we'll share that fiscal note when it comes. We'll have it requested.
Mr. Chairman, there is Senator someone here Pappas. From DHS, if Senator Rosen would like to hear from that person.
Oh, Mr. Chair.
Francie Hanser.
I guess I'm still
Senator
just
Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm still a little confused about who these outreach workers are connected with. Is it the family partnership that's going out, or is it a separate through the counties? And on the training, the personnel training, how is that going to be implemented? Who's doing that implementation? And before I lose the microphone, I'm not sure if I told you this, Mr. Bauer, but in my community, they're taking the young girls into Iowa and then drugging them. And then that's what's happening.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
Senator Pappas.
In the article this morning, girls were being trafficked by this ring in Minnesota, and that included, I believe, St. Paul, Brooklyn Park, and Maplewood. They're being trafficked in Wisconsin, Iowa, Ohio, Kentucky, Illinois, and Georgia.
Great.
Well, Senator Rosen, Mr. Chair,
Mr. Bauer,
to further answer your question, the outreach positions would be grant-funded positions, and it would be similar to how we've structured the regional navigators. And so they could be housed at a county. They could be housed at a nonprofit organization. We really wanted to keep it as flexible as we could because different things work in different communities around the state. So, for example, a nonprofit organization in your district would apply for a grant to house the youth outreach worker in their organization on a grant-funded basis. That youth outreach worker would be responsible for a region in your district, and they would go to the places where vulnerable youth tend to hang out, wherever that might be in your community, connect with them, develop relationships with them, and make the appropriate referrals. But it would be a competitive grant process, just like the regional navigators are, just like the comprehensive service grant funds are. And we anticipate that the training funds, the $1.2 million, would work roughly the same way. And so, say in northwestern Minnesota, there was a collaborative of folks who really thought that their emergency room nurses, their sexual assault nurses, and folks like that could use some training on this. They could apply for this grant. They would apply along with an organization that could train on those topics and move forward that way. That's a model that we've seen work really well in other areas, and we think it could work really well here. So I hope that answers your questions.
Mm-hmm. Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Bauer, point number two on your legislative agenda, $2 million allocated is inadequate to support the wide array of trauma-informed. Inadequate, help me understand what the gaps are and how you've determined it's inadequate. I feel like we started from zero and we're making progress, so help me understand what you filled and what gaps are left.
Mr. Power.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Great question. And so, as I said, we have there have now been 13 projects funded around the state with that kind of first round of funding that you all generously gave us. And that's really supplying services in a range of areas. And I'll take my little cheat sheet out so I can give you a couple of examples. For example, on the east side of St. Paul, there's culturally specific services. The Hmong American Partnership is providing for the Southeast Asian community. If you go to West Central, Wilmer, Lutheran Social Services, for example, is doing mobile case management. So they actually have a case management team that can go around and work with children wherever they are. In Olmsted County, their victim services group does advocacy, like legal advocacy and healthcare and things like that. And so we have those in a number of places in the state, but we haven't yet covered all of the places in the state that we need. And so I would say we have quite a few of those funded in the metro area right now. Duluth has a pretty strong funding stream. There are still, you know, if we look at northwestern Minnesota, especially for me right now, because so many of those kids are vulnerable to being trafficked up into North Dakota right now, I think that's an area we really need to focus on. You know, and southwestern and southeastern Minnesota, we're still not doing what we need to do. So we'd like to cover those areas is a few examples. And just in a statewide grant program with all of the needs that these kids come in with, they really, once they're discovered, they need everything from legal services to being reconnected with education to basic health care. I mean, you name it, they need it. We're really just scratching the surface so far.
Okay. And Senator Benson?
Mr. Chair, and Mr. Bauer, please don't think me silly. On outreach,
I never would, Senator Benson.
You haven't spent enough time with me then.
Maybe I would. I don't know.
I have teenagers. They're on social media probably more than I should let them be on social media. Are there, as these kids are in these situations, is there a way to connect with them there to look for them or to let them know there are resources? Please help me understand if that's even viable or on your radar.
Mr. Bauer.
Thank you, Senator Benson. Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's a great point. And I know a lot of the organizations now that work with youth and do youth outreach, that's really the way they communicate. You know, the youth, you know, like, well, we'll email you or call you for the meeting. The youth are like, what are you talking about? Just tweet it and I'll come or whatever. Yeah. Or whatever the kids are doing these
or
days.
Or Imgur or whatever, yeah.
Instagram. But it is a really important piece because that's where the communication happens. As we know, that's where the majority of the trafficking is happening now is over online media. And so It's another area I don't think we're doing enough on. I think it's an area we need to look much more closely at.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosen, did you have a
Yes, I did.
Question?
Thank you.
Senator
Thank you, Mr. Rosen. Chair. Well, to that, Mr. Bauer, what is our schools doing to help with this issue? Is there any classes, any information, any support system in the schools?
Mr. Bauer?
Senator Rosen, Mr. Chair. We really have not managed yet to have a very strong presence in the schools. I'll be frank with the committee. It's really hard to get into schools, and a lot of schools have been reticent to take this on as an area of curriculum.
They don't want to talk about the S issue.
Senator Pappas.
I'm going to let Senator Pappas.
Mr. Bauer.
What S issue?
Senator Rosen.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Bauer.
I would yield to Senator Pappas.
Senator Pappas?
Mr. Chairman, I'm just making a joke about these issues can be controversial within schools.
Yes. I will say, Senator Rosen, Mr. Chair, if I may, that there has been some success with sort of out-of-school groups that are still school-affiliated. So oftentimes they'll have sort of girls' groups after school, things like that. We have been able to get in that way in some ways. At times, there can be sort of healthy dating relationships type curriculum that we can get in on. But in terms of actually integrating into school curriculum, it's been very challenging.
Senator Rosen?
So, Mr. Chair, Mr. Bauer, is there a disconnect as far as our schools and our education system not even realizing the issue? I would assume they realize the issue, and they're just turning a blind eye to this, or do we need to have, if this money is coming through our departments, do they need to start talking to each other to develop some kind of coordination and collaboration? Because that you would think that that would be a obvious jumping point, or place where you could start is in the schools, and somehow they have to know that the females are being compromised at the schools.
Mr. Bauer?
Senator Rosen, Mr. Chair, that's certainly a discussion we would love to have with the appropriate parties to see what we could do. I don't know if Senator Pappas, if you have.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I was thinking more like we needed some kind of inoculation, that especially if girls are picked up at the Mall of America, which happens, and that they're vulnerable girls at a sensitive time, maybe they're loners, a pimp approaches them, smooth talker is going to be their boyfriend. I mean, that's kind of how they're reeled in, many of these young girls. And if there could be some kind of inoculation, like beware of smooth talkers at the Mall of America.
There's a song in the 50s.
Senator Benson?
If I could, to that point, Mr. Bauer, I don't know. I like Senator Rosen's line of questioning. And with all due respect, Senator Pappas, I think inoculation is an okay idea, but I don't think necessarily a curriculum. I'm more concerned at this point, school counselors, principals.
Being able to identify. Mr. Chairman, you mean being
Senator
able to
Pappas.
Identify. Yeah.
Helping to identify is, Mr. Bauer, is any of your training going to those places?
Mr. Bauer?
Senator Benson, Chair Lori, the training fund that we're hoping to fund through this bill this year, that would be one eligible category of funding school districts could apply. And I also just want to make one more point so it doesn't get lost, is that we really need to do a lot of work with our boys as well when we're thinking about school curriculum and things like that. One side of the coin certainly is for young women to know what to look for and not be victimized. But another large piece of this is how to teach our boys not to be purchasers and predators.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions of the committee? Seeing none, Senator...
Mr. Chair, I so move that Senate File 552 be laid over for possible inclusion in the...
As amended.
As amended, thank you.
On that motion, any further discussion? Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to offer testimony either in support or opposition to Senate File 552? Seeing none on Senator Rosen's motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Senator Saxog, Senate File 672. I see we have an author's A1 amendment in members' packets.
I do, Mr. Chair.
Senator Franzen moves the A1 amendment. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Same sign. Motion prevails. We have the bill in shape. Senator Saxog.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Today I'm presenting Senate File 672. We took care of the author's amendment, and this bill provides $250,000 grant to the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe Ambulance Service for equipment upgrades, training, and education. With me today is Joe Bedrello, who's going to, from the Leech Lake Band, who's going to give a brief presentation and help answer any questions the committee might have.
Mr. Boudreau, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and present your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee. My name is Joseph Boudreau. I'm a paramedic and I am a training officer for Leech Lake Ambulance, a small basic life support service in northern Minnesota and Cass Lake.
And did you have some testimony to help us understand the need for this?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Currently, we are a basic life support service, meaning we can still do some pretty standard medical assessments and trauma care. And we do have a fair amount of the EMTs on the basic level have a fair amount of knowledge of anatomy and physiology and some hazmat training and the ability to give some basic medications for people who may be having anaphylactic shock or asthma reactions, things like that. Our intention is to upgrade the provider level to advanced emergency medical technician and eventually paramedic, which would give the service an advanced life support designation. So advanced EMTs have a wider knowledge of anatomy and physiology, pharmacology, and medication administration. They also can manage trauma and medical emergencies and also take care of these patients with these kind of emergencies. Advanced EMTs also have an increased knowledge of cardiac emergencies and managing them. Also, area management and respiratory care is included here. Paramedics have this and more. Paramedics have the ability to monitor cardiac arrhythms and treat them with medications and electricity. They can also utilize advanced airways and manage a patient who would need these. They can also give medications to manage those in pain or in need of sedation. So with these desired designations comes the need for equipment to provide the care briefly outlined and the training to reach these levels for the care of the patients that the ambulance service responds to. Leech Lake Ambulance has a service area that covers 550 square miles. The service area has four counties involved, with Cass County being the primary. We've logged over 1,300 calls last year, and that number seems to increase annually. We do provide care and respond to medical emergencies and trauma emergencies, not just for band members, but whoever may be in our service area, and especially the influx of tourists and summer residents that we have, which probably doubles and triples the population of that county. So the calls dispatched can be as far away as 30 miles, and given the weather can be a factor, we would have the ability to respond to these patients and provide advanced care, and this would greatly enhance survival rates.
All right, Mr. Boudreau. Any questions of members?
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This question is actually for you, or how does the funding of the Office of Rural Health and Safety work again? Mr. Albrecht.
Albrecht is shaking his head that he doesn't know. Is there somebody from Mr. Greenman from MDH here? Maybe you could come help us understand how a grant of this sort would be Mr. Greenman, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, Dave Greenman. I'm the budget director with the health department. The way we read this language, it would appear that we would just simply be a pass-through for the grant. It's going directly to the recipient, so there would be no RFP process or anything like that. It would just be simply
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But Mr. Greenman, is there a lump sum of money that the Office of Rural Health and Safety is appropriated every budget year, and then and where does a lot of that funding? Is this the appropriate fund for it?
Mr. Greenman, is this the right way to direct the money to get them, to get to the Leech Lake Band?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, the Office of Rural Health and Primary Care would probably be the correct place within the department for the money to go and then to be issued. They work with a lot of to support the healthcare system out in the rural areas quite a bit, and do some work with trauma and emergency care. Typically, for a bill like this, the money would just go directly to the commissioner. It wouldn't name the specific office within the department to get the funds. So we do, our office is funded to do a number of different things through the out in the healthcare systems, through federal funds, through the Healthcare Access Fund, and I believe we receive some general fund dollars as well to do various types of activities. This would just be another one that we would take on. Does that answer your question? I'm not sure if it does.
But it sounds like maybe it would just be more straightforward to, on line 1.8, cross out through the Office of Rural Health, and I guess it changed to primary care, and then it's just a grant to the Commissioner of Health to provide, appropriation to the Commissioner of Health to provide to the Leech Lake Band. Is that clear? I mean, it doesn't need to run through this Office of Rural Health and...
Mm-hmm. Right.
Is that something that, okay, Senator Rosen moves? Ms. White, did I state that clearly enough? I know that the A1 amendment actually changed that a little bit. Oh, I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, I think that's sufficient.
Okay. Everyone understand Senator Rosen's oral amendment? On that motion, any questions? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
And Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Oh, I'm sorry. No, that's okay. I have two questions, and one is Senator Saxhog. Is this ongoing? Is this something that we have to look maybe more specifically to our Native American reservations and the situation that is with a lot of the tribes? Is there a deficit that we need to start looking at for the tribes ongoing?
And I guess, Senator Rosen, it sort of, is this intended to be an ongoing appropriation, or is this a one-time cost to get you from BLS to ALS type of service, and then once you're ALS, would you be sufficient at that? Is that...
And Mr. Chair, if there is the other tribes and bands going to be coming, looking for an appropriation to deal with this specific issue, and is there room to look at expanding into a community paramedic model, which would be, I think, really appropriate for the reservations?
And are there enough community paramedics getting through the system to
exactly
to make it that deep? I hope soon.
Yeah, exactly.
Senator Rosen,
this is intended right now to be one time, but that doesn't mean that, as Senator Rosen was just talking about, if we find a solution here and it continues to need money, it just so happens I have another bill over in education that deals with sparsity, and up north we have sparsity issues. Mr. Bedreau just mentioned that he has over 525 square miles in his area, and that's what really makes it so difficult to get those types of services. Particularly in the winter, when we get into the tourist season, there's a lot of people around, and mm-hmm. it's a very important service, and I think that upgrading it as this proposes is a terrific idea.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Rosen,
could we bring Mr. McAlpin up to the table and
is
have
Mr.
him
McAlpin
explain
in the room?
Apparently I don't not. I thought I saw him.
See him? He's always here. What?
Now we can talk about him.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Saxon.
And Senator Rosen, Mr. Bedreau said Mr. McAlpin went to a House hearing.
Okay.
You know, does anyone from MDH have any insights into whether there's additional aid? I don't even know if all of the tribes or how many of the tribes offer ambulance service of any sort, and how many of them are basic life support and how many of them are advanced life support. I mean, I don't know, and I see some shaking of heads that MDH doesn't know the answer to these questions either. So, I mean, I guess what we have before us here is a proposal to assist the Leech Lake Band ambulance service to get from a BLS-type service offered for this large rural area to get to ALS, advanced life support. Senator Benson, you had a question as well?
And Mr. Chair, it's kind of along these lines. I'm seeing this really as a piece placed in the middle of something I don't fully understand. Do we have, as Senator Rosen asked, other tribes that have similar needs or other areas of the state that have similar needs? And is this the normal way that we would boost up somebody from BLS to ALS? It's all out of context for me, and I'm disappointed that Mr. McAlpin can't be here. Perhaps our testifiers could help me understand. Is this the way other ambulance services move from BLS to ALS?
Senator Saxog, Mr. Boudreau, do you have any insights into that?
Mr. Chair, Senator, we currently right now, I'm not sure of the information, that kind of information would exist right now. I know we would be the only advanced life support tribal ambulance service in northern Minnesota. The closest one would be the White Earth Reservation, and I'm pretty sure now that they are part-time advanced life support. But other than that, covering the northern area of Minnesota, I do not know of any other advanced life support ambulance services run by a tribal.
Okay. Do you know how White Earth Band got from BLS to ALS? Did they come and ask for a grant to help to have the state support their advancement to ALS level of service?
Mr. Chair, I don't
you
have
don't
that
know.
Information.
Well, we can certainly ask some of these questions and try to get Senator Saxog. Maybe you can work with, Buck McAlpin and the Ambulance Association and try to get us some background on this, and we can share it with members.
Thank you.
As we move forward. Any further questions?
So, Mr. Chairman, we'll do our best to get more information to the
That'd be helpful, meeting. Senator Saxog. Any further questions? Seeing none, is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to offer testimony either in support or opposition to Senate File 672? Seeing none.
Mr. Chair, I'll
Senator Rosen moves.
I move that Senate File 672 as amended be recommended, passed, and laid over for possible inclusion.
On that motion, any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Senator Saxog.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee.
Thank you. Senator Clausen, FAME, Senate File 137. I don't know. What's this one?
As a member, as well. I gave it to the first. If this was about, they could have adopted that.
What happens right now? Just like a practical thing. It's been strong.
Senator Clausen, welcome.
Thank you, and good morning, Chair Lowry and committee members. We're here today to ask for a funding appropriation to support the Family Assets for Independence programs, or as it is known as FAME. In 2013, this committee supported FAME with an appropriation to help Minnesota low-wage earners take steps toward self-sufficiency by building assets. We are now requesting additional funding to support one aspect of the program, financial coaching. What I like about FAME is that the program empowers self-determination by providing an opportunity for people to invest in themselves. The Family Assets for Independence program is a matched savings project through which participants open savings accounts at local banks to save for one of three assets, a home purchase, post-secondary education, or to launch a small business. FAME participants set savings goals of up to $40 per month for 2 years, and the savings are matched $3 for every $1 saved up to a program limit. And once the goal has been reached, the FAME participant can maximize their savings goal of $40 per month. They will save $960 over a 2 year period and receive back $3,840. While working towards achieving their goal, FAME participants are assigned a coach to prepare for their future and complete financial education coursework. Currently, state and federal funding for FAME supports the matching savings account element of the program, enabling approximately 320 new Minnesota households to open savings accounts across the state. Funding, however, is not appropriated for the delivery of financial education coaching services. A biennium appropriation of $500,000 would enable FAME network providers to leverage other local, state, and federal funding support to reach an additional 250 households per year. Senate File 137 also adds a new section to the FAME statute that defines the role of a financial coach, which includes financial education and asset-specific training related to the goals established by the participant. The FAME program not only helps families build assets, but it builds communities by expanding home ownership, educational opportunities, and small business development. Many FAME participants move from being tax recipients to taxpayers. Research conducted by the University of Minnesota Humphrey Institute has shown a dramatic decrease in public assistance dependency following FAME participation. And at this time, we have three testifiers, Mr. Chair. Pam Johnson, representing Minnesota Community Action Partnership, Judy Bond, Anoka County Community Action Program, and Elizabeth Thompson, a FAME graduate and business owner.
Excellent. Ms. Johnson, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Pam Johnson, and I work with Minnesota's Statewide Community Action Partnership. Thank you for this opportunity to talk about Senate File 137, which, as Senator Klassen described, supports the statewide program, and we're very grateful to Senator Klassen for his support and to our co-authors, Senator Benson, Senator Rosen, Senator Marty, and Senator Herr. FAME has had a powerful and lasting impact in the lives of thousands of Minnesotans and has demonstrated a strong return on investment over the past 14 years. Over 3,600 Minnesota households have saved collectively nearly $3.5 million of their own income in matched savings account to acquire a long-term financial asset, a home, post-secondary education, or small business, as described. Long-term assets like these help families weather life's financial storms and move beyond paycheck-to-paycheck living. A statewide collaboration delivers FAME, comprised of Bremer Banks, City-County Federal Credit Union, Emerge Community Development, Community Action Agencies, the Urban League, Neighborhood Development Alliance, and Leech Lake Tribal Government. FAME participants deposit $40 per month at local banks and receive the 3-to-1 match described of state and federal funding. It's a true public-private partnership as the funds leverage local and private resources. Participants work with a trained FAME financial coach, who you will hear from shortly, to complete 12 hours of financial education and 10 hours of asset-specific training to address credit or debt issues and prepare for their asset purchase. And your packet contains the University of Minnesota Return on Investment Study that Senator Klassen described that reports that nearly 90% of surveyed FAME small businesses are still thriving after 2-plus years compared to a 46% national average. Over 85% of our education seekers met their goal or were in process, and there were no reported FAME home foreclosures despite the recent foreclosure crisis. We believe these outcomes are due to the one-to-one financial coaching and support that FAME participants receive. The classes alert them to risky consumer products and demonstrate wise financial habits for lifelong practice, which is passed on to the next generation. We're here today to thank you for your investment in FAME financial asset building over the past 14 years and to seek support for the key coaching aspect of FAME. The current $250,000 annual appropriation supports the FAME bank accounts as described, but not the key coaching element which makes the program so successful. FAME program providers have had to halt services due to a lack of adequate coaching funding, and this has created gaps in statewide service delivery, as shown in the map in your packets. Current FAME providers also struggle to secure stable resources and face service reduction. The bill would provide a $250,000 annual boost to stabilize the FAME coaching, enable former and new providers to join, and leverage private and non-state resources. Thank you for your time, and I'd like to now introduce Judy Bond, an expert FAME coach, and Elizabeth Thompson, a successful FAME graduate.
Who's going to go first? Ms. Thompson, is that right?
Judy Bond.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Judy Bond. I am the Acting Home Ownership Coordinator and FAME Coordinator at Anoka County Community Action Program. I have worked with the FAME program for a little over 2 years. I am very pleased to have this opportunity to speak with you today, not just about the importance of FAME matching dollars that help hundreds of families to secure invaluable assets of home ownership, small business development, and a college education. These assets propel and secure our families' financial futures, but the critical dollars that go into making the FAME program happen, FAME coaching. FAME coaching is an essential piece of this program that until now hasn't truly been understood or appreciated. FAME coaches receive intensive training using the curriculum entitled Four Cornerstones of Financial Literacy. That includes instruction on budgeting to increase savings, debt reduction, asset building, building a good credit rating, and consumer protection. In addition, our entire network participates in regular and ongoing statewide FAME network meetings and trainings under the program guidance and supervision of West Central Minnesota Community Action, the program's managing and fiscal agent. As providers, we share best practices, stay on top of current financial tools and topics, and support one another's efforts to provide high-quality coaching to our participants. As FAME coaches, we deliver 12 hours of financial training, 10 hours of asset-specific training, and ongoing individual coaching, the financial stability support, education and training that improves and sustains families' financial security. It's the coaching that truly makes the difference. At Anoka County Community Action, we are privileged to have the support of Anoka County and in the past, the United Way and Development Block Grants funds to help provide this FAME coaching. Without this support, FAME would not have been possible. There have been many partner agencies in the network that have stopped providing FAME, which is one of the great anti-poverty programs in Minnesota with countless proven results because of the lack of funding for the coaching. Having the tools of match savings is only effective if the coaching there is to support the people to capitalize on the match that makes it happen. The resources of FAME need to be spread statewide, and without coaching dollars, it's unlikely to happen. I sincerely hope you consider support for the FAME coaching bill. I would like to introduce one of my favorite FAME success stories, Elizabeth Thompson, of Daniel Thompson Tree Service, LLC. Elizabeth and Daniel joined the FAME program in 2012. They were the owners of a small tree trimming lawn care business, which started in 2008. While they were in the FAME program, the business was now able to expand and purchase a snowplow and were also able to hire their first employee. I will now let Elizabeth tell you the rest of the story.
Ms. Thompson, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and provide your testimony.
Thanks. Hi, my name is Elizabeth Thompson, And my husband and I, Daniel, have had a small tree service for several years, and we never made much profit. We were really struggling when we found FAME, but our FAME coach helped us to transform our business. We had so many ideas, but we didn't know which way to go. Through developing a business plan, which we had never done, we were able to narrow down our options. With the coach's help, we decided our best long-term investment was to buy a snowplow with the matching funds to expand the business during winter, which is our slowest time of year. Thanks to the plow, we picked up 30 contracts for snow removal this winter. Even with the lack of snow, this is the first winter that has not been a big financial struggle for us. The classes and the coaching helped us in all areas of our life, not just the business. Before FAME, we didn't know how to save or budget, especially with having an income that fluctuates so drastically from self-employment. Now even our kids love to save. We have a bucket that our whole family puts money in. When we want to do something special, like go on rides at the Mall of America, instead of putting it on our credit card, we count the bucket to see if we have enough. When the kids earn money from doing extra chores, they will literally run to the bucket to put their money in instead of buying candy or a cheap toy. FAME taught us all about delaying gratification. Without FAME's savings program, we would not have been able to buy a snowplow, and without the classes and coaching, we would not have had the skills to use the money wisely. Our family will be forever grateful for FAME, and I hope this program continues so it can transform other families as well.
Ms. Thompson, thank you for your story. I'm glad you were able to expand into a winter business as well. I know the seasonal can be very, very difficult. Any questions for Senator Claussen or any of the testifiers? Ms. Johnson, I know when you were in talking to me about this, you told us that you were yourself a financial coach back in the day.
Yes.
And had some really great stories as well. This is has always been a piece of what FAME was about, is the financial literacy component. And I think there was a little confusion in reading the bill. It looks like a new requirement that coaching be, but it is not a new requirement. It's new language in here, but it's really taking current practice, must be through rule or something, that a coach is required for the FAME program and putting it in statute. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, I believe the language was just added to clarify what the coaches do, just to give a definitional
background. But this has always been a key component of the FAME program and a key component behind the success. I mean, zero home foreclosures, these real successes in helping people get the financial tools that they need to get on their feet and independent is something that I know has received a great deal of support from the entire committee. So thank you for bringing this forward, Senator Claussen. Any questions of members? Senator Benson?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move that Senate file 137 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus finance bill.
On that motion, any further discussion? Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to offer testimony either in support or opposition to Senate File 137? Seeing none, on Senator Benson's motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Claussen.
Thank you, Senator and committee members.
Senator Dibble. Welcome to the committee, Senator Dibble, Senate File 548.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Yes, I have before you the Homeless Youth Act, Senate File 548, which, Mr. Chair and members, you heard about this a couple of weeks ago as a part of the larger Homes for All request. However, there is a policy change that moves the eligible age or the definition of homeless youth up from 21 to 24. So these grants, should this policy change occur, would allow young people to access or be eligible for the services under these grants up to their 25th or the day before their 25th birthday. And so I think that's the key reason why your request had become before you, to talk a little bit more about this part of the larger Homes for All request. Additionally, Mr. Chair, I don't think the Homeless Youth Act biennial report was ready at the last hearing. That has since been released. That's in your packet. And we have Francie Mathis from the Office of Economic Opportunity here who can help do a quick walkthrough of the report that talks about the dollars that have gone out the door and where they've gone and what their effect has been, if you so choose. Quickly, I'll just touch on the reason for moving the age up from 21 to 24. Currently, as I said, Homeless Youth Act are defined as 16 to 21. Other federal funding sources that support homeless youth use the age range from 20 up to 24, such as HUD and the Continuum of Care funding. And so this would allow the Homeless Youth Act grantees to align their resources with those federal resources that they use for these same services. It helps with administrative efficiencies, et cetera. That being said, some homeless youth services are listed specifically for ages 16 to 20 or 21. Those services won't be impacted. The larger reason, of course, is that the developmental stage of emerging adulthood is widely recognized as occurring between the ages of 16 and 24. And of course, we all know from our own experience with young people in our lives that they don't seem to be magically become adults. Once they turn 18 or 21, they still need some support and some help from us. Compounding those set of issues, of course, is the trauma of homelessness, the effect that has on brain development, the exacerbated consequences to poor decisions that are made by young people when they don't have supportive adults in their lives. And a lot of those supports, of course, are that they would otherwise derive from their families or other loving, supportive adults that are in their lives that they're related to are replaced by the agencies and the adults in the agencies that are supported through these grants. So that's the main and basic reason. To the larger funding request, which I think you heard about, you probably are aware of the Homeless Youth Act history. The policy language was established in 2006 that established the continuum of care that was recognized through some study and some analysis and a report that was actually done by the Department of Human Services, Beth Holger Ambrose, who was here earlier, sitting right in that chair a few minutes ago. She was here. She's now at the link. And she was here interested in the sexual trafficking issues, but she was in on the ground floor when she worked for the Department of Human Services to establish the groundwork for the 2006 bill. And then we started a little bit of appropriation to fund those competitive grants, starting with a little less than $250,000, and then we got $1 million a couple years later. At that point, Rainbow Research did a study to determine the effectiveness and found out this is really effective for getting young people what they need on a path towards successful adulthood. Then we had the very successful year last year, appropriating $4 million for the biennium, and then when we did the supplemental, an additional $1 million or $2 million for the biennium for a total of 6.238. The level of requests that came in, though, were for $20 million, out of which about $10 million were deemed to be really responsive and worthy grant applications. The report that Francie will present on, if you so desire, will talk about the level of need and its geographic distribution and the fact that we could very much use this additional appropriation to start to get to and address the identified need and get to the desired outcomes that are out there. That's what I have for the time being. I can just pause for questions, or we can invite Ms. Mathis up for
One question I'd have, and I don't mean to put you on the spot, but we'll have tight budgets as always. I'm wondering, is this policy change from 21 to 24, is this kind of a separate issue, or is it linked to additional funding? Does it stretch existing funding too thin if we don't have some level of additional funding this year, or is it kind of an independent good policy change to be moving forward? Not having a target yet, I don't know where we will wind up, but I need to kind of figure out.
Mr. Chair, I would say they are somewhat delinked from each other.
Okay.
This is an important policy change in and of itself. I think the need for funding also kind of stands on its own,
yes.
Whether we keep the age at 21 or move it up to 24.
Okay. That's helpful. Senator Benson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question was a little bit along your line. If we add those extra 3 years and we don't put in the $2 million, does that reduce the number of services available? I just want to wrap my head around what happens to the services for 21 and under if we can't get the $2
million. Senator Dibble.
Mr. Chair, if you look on page 6 of the report, which is kind of subject number 3, identification of needs, and if you look down at the last paragraph there, that kind of shows you how we've done quite a bit of good work. But it talks about how that there were 108 emergency shelter beds, 15 of which were in Greater Minnesota, 341 transitional housing programs, 159 in Greater Minnesota and reservations, et cetera, et cetera. This is all really good work, and these are great numbers, but I think the operative sentence is it's falling short of meeting the needs of homeless youth. So I think, the good work will continue, and there was a significant jump, especially in Greater Minnesota, in terms of the number of agencies that were served for the first time. I think there were something like 13 agencies funded in Greater Minnesota of 18 applications that were received. But we'll just simply continue to fall short of the need.
Maybe we will hear a quick step through, because sure. I think we're kind of going over what this is. And so maybe we will just get a step through and know that last time we had this up, this geography question, where are the gaps? Mm-hmm. What is happening to homeless youth across the state were very prominent in the discussion that we had. So maybe we'll have a walkthrough and then a few more questions. Does that work for members?
That would be great.
Senator Benson?
And Mr. Chair, I'm just looking in the report, and I'm going to need somebody to call out for me. What happens to these kids? Are we tracking if they're moving into treatment, if they're getting their GED, where are they a year down the line? Is that something that homeless Youth Act grant recipients do? And so, I'd just like to know where they end up.
Senator Dibble.
I think Ms. Mathis will cover that, but if you want to jump ahead, Senator Benson, that's in item number 6, which is on page 12. And they're starting to get to some of those outcome measures, I think the major indication is that they need a little bit more, like another year's worth of data to really be really accurate on some of those outcome measures, but they're definitely starting to take those measures.
Ms. Mathis, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and walk us through a high-level.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Francie Mathis from Department of Human Services. This report was required in the statute and specifically asked for identification of needs, the details of how the grants were awarded, the geographic distribution, activities, and outcomes. And so if you look on page 6, identification of needs, we used the Wilder study for as being the most complete and accurate measure of homeless youth. However, the researchers do say that there's a significant undercount of homeless youth because, as you know, youth do a lot of couch hopping, and then, you know, they're not in the system, so we're not able to find them. So, but that's where we started with our identification needs. In the bottom portion of that page, the geographic area, According to Wilder, 4 in 10 youth, or 42%, were in Greater Minnesota. So we took that seriously as we were looking at geographic distribution of the awards in the last RFP session. So turning the page to page 7, we did a competitive RFP, request for proposal, for the funding and had a pretty comprehensive review committee from people in local area in the local areas as well as state staff. 49 applications were received, requesting more than $20 million, as Senator said, five times the amount of dollars that were available. In addition, then, there was another $1 million appropriated last spring. Rather than doing another RFP, which is a time-consuming process, we sent out a request for additional funds to the grantees that we had funded in the year before, realizing that we didn't fund anyone at the amount that they asked for. And so in some cases, people had made a little beginning but weren't really able to implement the project that they requested. So with that, we got 24 of the 30 grantees that we had funded in the first round, requested more money, and funds were awarded to 21 of the applicants. Turning on to page 8, there's a description of the activities that Homeless Youth Act allows, and it is a very broad and in a good way, a very broad statute. So everything from prevention, which is some of the school programs we were talking about earlier with Safe Harbor, street outreach, drop-in centers, shelters, and supportive housing, including time-limited, which would be like a transitional housing program or permanent housing. Just a note back on the question of age. What happens oftentimes in the local area is a youth would be in the program. Now they have their birthday, and then do they have to leave even though they're not really ready to leave? Well, what happens is the providers scramble around and try to find other funding to fund that kid until they finish that program. So this would, the age thing would really make a difference there. Turning on to page 9, talks about the increase in the different areas with this homeless youth funding. In outreach and drop-in, you can see on the little graph, there were 8 providers, now there are 13. Shelter, it talks about the beds previously and with the increase, and then the supportive housing. And I think then the pie chart below shows the funding by type. We've tried to slice it and dice it all the different ways. On page 11, talks about geographic distribution of funds. So we had a big increase based on the Wilder study, a big increase into Greater Minnesota. Many times these were new grantees, though, so they are starting out small. So we may have a few beds in a lot of different areas, but they're not fully developed programs as yet. and then we did a significant increase into suburban metro areas, which was very much needed. And 2 tribal governments also received this funding. On page 12 are the activities and outcome indicators. It did take some time with this new funding to determine what are the outcomes that we should be requesting and how should we be collecting that data. And we worked with Wilder and we worked with the homeless youth providers to determine that. And they all started collecting the data in the middle of the biennium. So last summer. So we have a solid 6 months of data, but not as much complete data as you would like, and that will be coming as we go forward. And that's a quick walkthrough. Are there any questions?
I have one question. It goes to the overlap of kids. How many, do you know how many of these kids would be considered sexually exploited or sex trafficked when they come to you to find service?
Mr. Chair, that's an excellent question, and I don't think anyone really knows yet. Safe Harbor also is funded through our office, and we're learning so much as we go. There is an indication that any child on the street is very likely vulnerable to being trafficked, and many of the kids are having survival sex, which has a lot of trauma with it as well. So what the scope of all of that is, we are not sure at this point.
And you mentioned something about school screenings. How have you been able to work with the schools? I know we had a lot of questions mm-hmm. about that in the first bill we had on the agenda. How has that worked for you, and you're doing some screenings in the schools? That
Mr. Chair, not screenings, but we do have our providers have staff who go into the schools, have connected with the guidance counselors, you know, and have worked that way. The school liaisons are well connected with our providers. So on that side, on the homelessness side, I think there is, you know, well, of course, it varies across the state, but in many places, I think there's a nice connection. In some places, it's not as strong. Probably some places, it doesn't exist at all. But it is really on the sex trafficking part that I think we don't have as good a connection.
Senator Dibble?
Mr. Chair, this doesn't quite get to the question with precision, but some of the data that comes out of the Wilder research, I'll just read some of these statistics. So 25% of homeless adults report their first experience of homelessness with their parents or alone was at age 17 or younger. So you can imagine how vulnerable someone, you know, oftentimes the sex trafficking occurs after someone becomes disconnected from their family. Sometimes it's a function of how they become disconnected from their family, but often it happens they find themselves out on the street. 30% have stayed in abusive situations because they had no other housing options. And 42% report having experienced physical abuse, parental neglect, 27% sexual abuse. So that gets you some sense of the overlap.
Senator Rosen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Dibble, you know, you've been working on this a long time, and I've been at your side on this every step of the way.
Yeah, thank you.
But I'm going to be a bulldog about this because I'm doing the high math, and I do have the Homeless Youth Act Awards from 2013-2014. And I think it's a little, and I'm not saying to you, Senator Dibble, but a little misleading, disingenuous in this geographic distribution of funds on page 11. 42% of the youth identified in the Wilder Research study are from Greater Minnesota, and it says of 18 applications received from Greater Minnesota, 13 were funded. So I'm doing the high math, and I don't know if anybody else around the committee has this this spreadsheet here, but $687,000 was given to St. Louis County, and I'm from right now I want to say I'm not saying no one is not deserving of these funds, but the disparity of the funding is a little misleading on that comment that there is 13 were funded and we have a great proportion in Greater Minnesota, because from I-94 South, Mankato and Olmsted County are the only two areas that were funded. Mankato, $110,000, and Olmsted mm-hmm. County was it?
About the same.
$130,000. Now, I'm going to tell you, Mr. Chair and Senator Dibble, we have homeless out there. We aren't even addressing Southwest Minnesota at all, or the western side of the state. And $130,000 for Olmsted is very sad. It's very sad. And so I'm hoping we had this conversation last year. I'm hoping that we are adjusting that. I don't know where the disconnect, if these folks are not applying for the grants, if they're not aware of the grants, if the system isn't built up enough for these people to apply for the grants, we have to get the funding more appropriate and more proportionate out to greater Minnesota. And I'm certainly not saying Duluth doesn't deserve it, because I know they have a problem, but so does Moorhead, and so does Wilmer, and so does Worthington, and so does Marshall, and so does Mankato and Albert Lea, and we're just forgetting this huge ring around the state. So, again, Senator Dibble, you know I'm not. You have done a stellar work on this. I just think this is really sad when my area I serve barely got anything out of the $4.2 million, barely.
Senator Dibble.
So, Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, I appreciate it. I think we went from almost nothing to $1.8 million. I don't know, though, with precision, of those 13 applications that were funded, of the 18 received, where they came from, or why the other five came from. But Ms. Mathis, I'm sure, can answer with greater precision.
Ms. Mathis.
Mr. Chair. Senator, we had this discussion last time as well, and really the issue in this round was those were the only two applications that were received, and they were small programs that asked for small amounts. We have been, since that time, recruiting and talking. That money, that funding came kind of suddenly for some of the providers. So people who didn't serve homeless youth before didn't think to apply for it. We have done some talking, and in our regular grant monitoring process have been talking about homeless youth. One of our staff has put together a sheet about how it's different to serve homeless youth, and so we feel strongly that we would have additional providers now in the Southwest for sure. And we also did fund programs in Moorhead and Leech Lake, and Wilmer has some funding, although for homeless youth, although not this funding. But we would ship them probably over to this funding. So it's evolving, but at the time that we did the original RFP, we funded the only ones that applied in the South.
So, Mr. Chair,
Senator Rosen,
and Ms. Matheson, what do we need to do to help these people apply? Is there just the services, the backbone for these services is not even there for them even to know how to apply? They don't have the manpower to apply for the grant. I mean, perhaps that's the problem. I don't know, but it just seems like we're not serving the entire state.
Ms. Mathis, is there any type of outreach to build the capacity to request these grants, or is it sort of a wait for them to come forward? I mean, I think there is great need all across the entire state. And
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, there is a need for program development, and as I said, we have been working through our regular granting process and monitoring organizations. We have been talking about the Homeless Youth Act and how it's different to serve youth than adults, because we do have adult serving programs all across the state. However, it is different to serve youth, and so we do need staffing, a specific staff person who knows about homeless youth, who has run homeless youth programs, to really assist the grantees, the adult providers that exist, to develop that programming and hire the right staff, because we want to be sure if we're funding a program that it's going to be a successful program for the youth.
Ms. Mathis, you say you need that position. Do you have it, or is it part of this request that you would hire that? I was looking at, I do see that the funding is available. You're able to use it for technical assistance and capacity building, so that is an allowed use, and you say you need this function. Do you have it today, or would that be a part of this expanded appropriation?
Mr. Chair, that would be part of the expanded. We don't have any administrative funds for this project at all. So we've been trying to make do the best we can, and we just don't have a capacity to do the level of work that really is needed. So we've done, as I say, what we can in the context of our regular work, but we do need a specific position for that.
Okay. Senator Hayden?
Well, I think, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think you, Mrs. Mathis, has kind of touched on what I was going to touch on, and I know that there's a frustration. I've done a little bit of this work even before I got in the legislature, and often it is the infrastructure that works on homeless issues as a whole that then starts to spread out and get into the other groups of folks, sexually exploited youth, teens, et cetera. And if you look at some of the awards, at least by just eyeballing it, I can see that there's a tremendous amount of infrastructure always in the metro area, because that's especially in the core cities, and then Duluth, and then some of the tribes have been working on supportive housing issues and have been kind of focused on that. And so I think that there is infrastructure that was already there. I do think that there is an issue of capacity building, which Mrs. Mathis was focused on. But I really do think that that's what we need to do, is that often really go out to those organizations and youth-serving organizations and organizations that serve the homeless and figure out how to put those together. Otherwise, I do think that it will be, if they're scoring this in whatever way that they're scoring it, these other organizations and regions are always going to kind of rise to the top, or you're just going to have folks who are going to be stretched to even get an application in. So I would suggest that we strongly look at if we're going to continue to fund, are we going to fund this at a higher level, that there is a really strong emphasis on the capacity building. In addition to that, Mr. Chair, I do think that we should explore the question that Senator Benson asked, that I'm not sure that we got. Mrs. Mathis kind of touched on it, that there's a continuation of young people that are in the program that hit 21 and aren't quite ready to go, aren't finished with whatever program or curriculum that they have, and I think that that gets them to 24. But there also could be, Senator Dibble, I think, a new crop of young people that come in at 21 to 24. And I'd like to kind of better understand that and figure out how do we ensure that if we're going to make the policy change to be aligned with the federal government to 24, that we aren't stretching those resources thin, and thus we get less of a bang of a buck that we have today. I'm all for 24, but we should fund that appropriately, or at least understand what that looks like from the providers and the people that are doing the work to ensure that we're not going to then kind of exacerbate the problem by doing an unintended consequence, if you will, by going to the federal conformity of 24. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, I can
Senator Dibble?
I can move my funding request up from the bill's
and add that FTE to and did you have a response, or we have some other questions as well? I see.
I will support strongly this notion that we work with agencies in all parts of the state to talk about, you know, this idea of supporting homeless youth unattached, unaffiliated from their families is, believe it or not, kind of a new idea. Not to me, but to the larger kind of homeless housing industrial complex. It's, you know, kind of fought our way into, you know, to be recognized as a unique set of services that really does need to have its own special set of identified capacity and competencies and that sort of thing. So a lot of great agencies in greater Minnesota, a lot of great people working in this whole realm. But when they think about youth, they think about young people, you know, kids with their mom. And this is a unique cohort, a unique population. So building that capacity and competency. And then just the capacity to, I have a copy of the RFP here. It's, you know, it's a big packet. I mean, that's a good thing, because it really drives to the ability to deliver good services and measurable outcomes. But that takes a lot of staff time, a lot of effort that a lot of agencies just don't have. I mean, I used to be a nonprofit executive director. I know how much work it is to put in just applications, much less, you know, all the grant requests you have to write, all that sort of thing. So assisting with some of that capacity building would be a good thing. I know that the coalition tries to help partner agencies, and so that might also be another resource. The age thing, So, like I said before, it's a good policy that stands alone. You know, whether or not we do make that policy change, I think the resources are still inadequate to the task. We should still do the appropriation. The appropriation helps also, you know, get us up to 24. Again, it's about aligning the eligible sources of funding, because there's a lot of leveraging that goes on with private fundraising as well as federal grants. So I hope that helps answer that question. Susie Schatz from LSS is here to help us a little bit as well.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Susie Schatz from Lutheran Social Service of Minnesota. I also help to convene Youth Moving Forward, which is a statewide coalition of youth, homeless youth service providers and others who care about homeless youth in Minnesota. And when we asked this question to those providers, they said absolutely they were not concerned about this. We had the same kind of concern when it was brought to us. Okay. And the fact is, as Senator Dibble mentioned, and we've heard, these are still young people. The biggest support this would provide is, of course, in that administrative alignment with the federal resources. But the fact is, these are our young people who would be served in an adult system where Ms. Mathis mentioned, you know, youth are different. And so serving them in the homeless youth system is much more appropriate than serving them in the adult system, and we believe would take some of the strain off of that system as well and have them serve more appropriately. And as Senator Dibble mentioned, there are programs within the Homeless Youth Act that are licensed up to age 22 only, and so that wouldn't impact them at all. They would still continue that to serve that age group.
Okay. Senator Benson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just wanted to echo some of the geographic concerns we heard about Lutheran Social Services outreach in Willmar on the sex trafficking bill, the sexually exploited youth bill. And as I'm looking down the list of Homelessness Youth Act grantees, I don't see Candio High Swift, Renville, Yellow Medicine, Lacquaparo. We're missing a big chunk of the state that somehow we've, on the sex trafficking side, said we need some sort of outreach there. And yet, when it comes to homelessness, and it might be capacity, et cetera, it feels like one group is identified that there's a need, and I hope that there's some connection going on. You talked about that, Mr. Chair, the Homeless Youth Act working with the sexually exploited youth people. So I want to echo Senator Rosen's geography question. I'm really stuck on this 24-year-old thing. Senator Hayden brought up another point about new people coming in. Is there some room, and maybe Ms. Mathis, you can help me with this, is there room? Is it an alternative idea that someone who's in an existing program can continue in that program till age 24 and it's not a new entry point, or does that conflict with federal guidelines and make it too complicated?
Ms. Mathis?
Mr. Chair, Senator, the programs specialize, I would say. Different providers specialize in the different age groups. Some specialize in the way younger group, 12 to 17. Many of the programs will take the children, you know, 15 or 16 until they turn 22 with the Homeless Youth Act money, and then they have to, you know, they can't continue to pay for the services for that child, even though they may still need the services a little longer. So then they do, I don't say that they're, you know, unenrolling them, because I think what they do is, you know, cobble together some funding to try to continue to serve that kid. This just will smooth out for those providers, the funding issues. So I don't see that it's going to have a huge impact, although I understand where you're coming from, but functionally it doesn't feel like there's going to be a huge impact.
Senator Benson?
And Mr. Chair, my limited experience is with Hope for Youth in Anoka, and they're seeing more of these older kids, but it makes it a less comfortable environment for the 16 to 18-year-olds. And so are we having some sort of adverse consequence that we're not aware of by moving it up to 24? We have a program that welcomes 16-year-olds and 24-year-olds. Those are very different people developmentally. And I just want to be thoughtful that we're not taking away from that under 21 crowd to meet some sort of arbitrary federal rule. I understand the need for a continuum. If someone starts at 18 or 19 or 20 and they hit 21 and they're dumped because there's not money, I understand the need for a continuum, but I want to be really careful. 8 years is a big developmental range that we're trying to deal with. So that would be my concern about going to 24.
Okay. You know, I'm going to return to one I started talking about a little bit earlier, this coordination between the two. You know, I mean, one of the things that we heard was that schools are very hard to approach when the frame is sexually exploited youth. And, I mean, I think we had a little conversation about that. It sounds like schools are much easier to approach when the frame is homelessness. And, I mean, I think some of the points we were trying to get to is these counselors and the school professionals who interact with these kids absolutely need some of the training to identify sexual exploitation, sexual trafficking, whatever you want to call it, but coming at it from the frame of homelessness maybe is a much better avenue to access the sensitivity that we need to get to in schools. And so I would ask the groups to work together to bridge that, because it was, you know, I think clearly identified through the discussion that we had today that our Safe Harbor friends are really having a hard time making that inroad, and it sounds like you guys have a lot of good relationships there, and so we do need to get those folks in the schools that are working with a lot of the same kids the sensitivity and the awareness and the training to recognize when that sexual exploitation is a piece of what a child is going through. So I'd like to ask you to continue that work and look for that as another avenue to coordinate on. Senator Rosen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, Senator DeDevil, I'm half Italian, so I get pretty worked up about this, and this is pretty consistent with. but I just want to explain and then ask a question. In greater Minnesota, especially deep rural, and I use that very, very, I mean, it is deep rural. The resources are not there. They do a lot of this stuff by themselves. Just because they don't, as you eloquently said, they don't have the ability to fill out a grant RFP. And so many times they are skipped over, but they tend to just take care of their issues by themselves, which is a shame because there are so many gaps there. Going forward, we have to adjust this. We have to figure out how we are going to get to those kids that don't even have the opportunity to go to a homeless shelter that's up in the cities or to a larger metropolitan area. They are barely surviving out there, and there are many. So, Ms. Schatz, what is Lutheran Social Services doing about that? Because I feel that is the one organization that can get to this deep rural issue, and I'm hoping that you have some kind of game plan, because going forward, we cannot continue to allow this to happen.
Ms. Schatz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senator Rosen. That is an excellent question. And we've actually been working the last several years with some of our partners in the community, Catholic Charities Twin Cities, Wilder, the Interagency Council to End Long-Term Homelessness, at looking at exactly that. How do you get out in those areas where it doesn't make necessarily sense to have its own standalone homeless youth shelter, et cetera? But there are creative ideas that are happening. And I know in this last round of funding with the Homeless Youth Act, other folks, especially in greater Minnesota, were looking into things like host homes for homeless youth, which are really taking off here in the metro area. How can we do that? There are lots of folks who have empty bedrooms and would be willing to share that with the homeless youth. So we're looking at creative ways that we can get to that, and I'm happy to follow up with you with some of the specifics of that plan and of those proposals and discussions that we've been having to look at exactly what you're talking about.
Senator Hayden, and I think we're getting...
Just to follow
kind
up
of
on that.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senator Hayden. I'm hoping that you'll come and talk to the entire committee about that, because that is something that sounds very, with great potential.
Absolutely.
The possibility. You're right. We don't have the resources to build a standalone, but we have to do something. And that's where this act, Senator Dibble, and your efforts and your work on that is imperative to move something like this forward.
Absolutely.
Mr.
Be happy to.
Senator Dibble.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'll just say I appreciate the passion. I used to live in Italy.
So my hands were cold.
Being a Swede, I'm being pretty passionate myself. And I'm passionate about this, and I share your passion. And, you know, I just want to recognize Senator Rosen and Senator Benson. You've had, you know, a lot of effect. I mean, we went from almost nothing, if you look at the county served, you know, a lot more greater Minnesota counties than there were this time last year. So that's progress. And so what I want to do is get a big map of the state of Minnesota with all the counties, and then we're going to color them in together. And when the state is completely filled in.
Mr. Chair, I have crayons.
Senator Benson, Senator Dibble, you don't even know. We've been looking for the big whiteboard. Senator Rosen keeps trying to get me to get out the color crayons.
And, Mr. Chair, I'll just say that I was part of a community collaborative years ago that helped establish the first of the host home programs, and that is a very successful model. I'm glad Ms. Schatz brought it up. You know, there's all kinds of creative ideas. There's the outreach, you know, street outreach to find these young people living in the fish shacks or God knows what out in the woods, you know, couch hopping around our communities, to find them in the first place and then figure out how to connect them to creative services so they don't have to come into the cities to find what they need.
All right. Well, this has been actually a really excellent discussion on an item that's already on our table, except for the 21 to 24 policy piece. Any further questions? Senator Rosen?
I would move, Mr. Chair, that Senate File 548 be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus.
On that motion, any further discussion? Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to offer testimony either in support or opposition to Senate File 548? Seeing none, on Senator Rosen's motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And with that, we stand adjourned. Thank